From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them.
The primaries are over. What did we learn, and what does it portend for the November midterm elections? I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, in for Matt Miller, and this is Left, Right, and Center. Bob Scheer joins me on the left from San Francisco. David Frum is on the right from Washington, D.C., and Arianna Huffington joins us by phone from New York. Republican women dominated in California. Democratic progressives lost in Arkansas. And the Tea Party has delivered us a Republican nominee for Senate in Nevada. What does it all mean? Let's start with the most important state in the union. We can all agree on that. California, the biggest state, the most people, the most money, and the most money in campaigns. Arianna Huffington, it was the night of the rich women. Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina putting out their own money to grab these nominations for governor and for Senate in California. What do you make of it?
Well, I don't have a problem with people spending their own money. I have a problem with people being bought. That's, for me, the problem our democracy is facing. So the fact that they spend their own money in the end is neither here nor there. And I don't just say that because my ex-husband, of course, was the pioneer of spending a lot of money in California.
David Frum, on the concept of being bought, it seems that even rich candidates can be, in effect, bought or captured by special interests. Is there something in these displays of wealth that we should find encouraging, or should we be looking at it for the way we suspiciously look at everything else in politics?
Be very disturbed by the way we finance campaigns. And the whole idea that candidates themselves raise the money is the problem. There's a very important book by my former AEI colleague Peter Wallison about this. The root of the evil in the American political system is our desire to prevent parties from giving money to candidates. Before 1940, parties raised the money, they distributed it to candidates, and the candidates spent it. That system had a lot of problems, but the current system has even worse. And all of our attempts to constrain what candidates do only compound it. You're in an inherently troublesome situation whenever candidates must ask interests for money for themselves or for somebody else. Better to put an agent in between, have the political party be the centralized fundraiser. And by the way, that would also strengthen sort of centrist and mainline candidates as against more extremist candidates who are able to connect to angry people for special interest donations.
Bob Scheer, does this week's result in California, where Meg Whitman spent $80 million, some are saying $90 million, which would be $90 per vote, a record high, is there something in that that makes you yearn for the good old days of clean campaign financing, possibly back in the 1940s, or some other era? I would point out that prior to the 1970s, most campaign contributions were completely untraceable and in cash, and we had no idea where they came from. Or while you're considering the good old days of campaign finance. Bob, go ahead.
No, I'm not that disturbed by it. I think, first of all, I think she's going to have a hard time with Jerry Brown, and I think he'll use her money against her. He'll talk about her buying the election, and he'll force her to take positions that will, I think, alienate her own base, because she's been very wishy-washy on some of those critical issues. Money can only do so much as far as papering over these kind of contradictions. I think the good news from California is that aside from the passage of Prop 14 and 13, the initiative process failed in the eyes of most voters. They didn't go for it. And in particular, PG&E was not able. They did a horrible thing. They spent $46 million trying to prevent municipalities from having their own electric power plants, which have been very successful in California, and would have required two-thirds, and they were defeated, even though they spent 57 times more than their opponents, because the public utilities aren't able to advertise or get involved in campaigns of that sort. So there was good news. As far as the really important thing, Prop 14, it's both positive and negative. I voted against it because I think their money will really talk, and it wipes out third-party candidates, and I think it should be thrown out by the courts. That's the bad news. I think it's an infringement on the democratic process, and you know, the two front runners, for those who didn't follow it, basically we're going back to the days when political parties didn't matter very much in California. It'll be the two front runners, and I suspect they'll either be front runners because they're celebrities, or they'll be front runners because they have $80 to $90 million to spend on their campaign, and it really wipes out the possibility of third parties. The good news is that the voters in backing that said, look, we just don't like the way things are going. There's gridlock, the safe seats, the two parties have solid control of what they care about, and the rest of us are suffering. And it was very interesting that both San Francisco and Orange County are the two counties that voted against it. Everyone else, every other county voted for it. In Orange County, the Republican Party is the strongest, maybe in the country. It gives the largest plurality. And they voted against this, along with the most liberal county, San Francisco. And I think in both cases, it was the establishment parties that felt threatened.
David, from on Proposition 14, I discovered only when I went in to look at the ballot as I was voting what it really says. I had the impression that the open primary that we were being asked to vote for was one in which no matter what party you were registered for, when you showed up to vote, like independent voters in California, you could ask for either ballot. You could ask for the Republican ballot or ask for the Democratic ballot. And no, it's a system in which there will be one ballot with all of the names on it. And the people who will be allowed to go into the November election are simply the top two out of that that column. Now, having been less prepared for this vote than I wanted to be as a California voter, I still voted for it. I went with my gut on this, my anti-establishment gut. Will I regret it?
They call these jungle primaries, the law of the jungle, a war of all against all. Louisiana, I think, is the only other state to have one. I don't think you'll regret it, especially not in conjunction with the reform to the way districting is done in California. Clearly, you have a problem in California where tiny ideological minorities are able to grab control of the state legislature and prevent your legislature from making intelligent financial decisions. There are a lot of other problems, the way that budgeting is done through initiative and referendum. But you have a fiscal crisis caused by your political system. You won't need to fix the political system, fix the fiscal system. You also need to change the political system so that this does not recur and solutions become possible.
Ariana, it's clear that the Proposition 14 style ballot is going. And by the way, there is a potential constitutional challenge to it. But assuming it survives a constitutional challenge, it clearly will favor the best financed and obviously most famous candidates. And our November ballots in California will now be much less colorful. We won't see the Green Party on there, and we won't see any of the minor parties on there that we have seen in the past, some of which can come in there from time to time and siphon away votes that affect the outcome. What do you make of this Proposition 14 future we're facing?
Well, you know, I feel a little bit like you, that going with my gut and voting for it, just because anything we can do to just shake up the way we've been running elections and the results we've been producing would be a good thing. I mean, at the moment, we've been only able to produce, as Tom Friedman put it, suboptimal questions to our biggest problems. So what can we do to ensure that we can start producing more optimal solutions?
Bob Scheer, what do you see as the model for the November elections in California when you see how Carly Fiorina completely buried Tom Campbell, who many would have called the more reasonable Republican candidate and the one with a better shot at the general election? She completely drowned out his message to the point where he functionally gave up campaigning in the final weekend. And if Meg Whitman can drown out Jerry Brown through an overwhelming television advertising campaign that he will not have probably more than half the money of Whitman. Is that something that you can pull off in the November election?
No. And first of all, I have a lot of respect for Tom Campbell. And however, I think he's a tired voice. He's run and run and run. And what the two women, businesswomen, represented, whether accurately or not, but how they were interpreted, as people who were can-do, who are positive, who are modern, who know the new economy, I think it was part of the reason, not for those kind of smarts, but why Schwarzenegger was popular. He seemed to be the unpolitician. And these two women, I think, carried that. I think they would have done well even without their money. I think Jerry Brown, however, will very effectively, he's a brilliant debater, expose the gaps in their knowledge and their positions and so forth. And at the end of the day, I think voters will want action. Let me just say, I am in a minority, I think, of one that does not think California is dysfunctional. I love this state. I love living here. I think most things work splendidly. What are we going to do, live in Alabama or Texas? I don't think those are models at all. And I think the big problem we have is with the initiative thing, particularly Prop 13, where we lost our funding base. And we have to straighten that out. We have to find a way to pay for the things that people want to pay for. But I don't subscribe to the idea that somehow we're living in a horrid place. Quite the opposite. Oh, I think it's the best place to live.
Bob, who said we're living in a horrid place?
No, I'm just saying, I mean, I don't want to throw out the reason I voted against this. I don't feel the kind of desperation that we should throw everybody or throw the bums all out and so forth. I think what we need to do is find a base of revenue to support the funding that most people in the state want. And what Prop 13 did was irrationally destroy that base in property taxes, and yet we don't, it basically favored the corporations, and we don't have a way of getting the revenue that is needed. But in general, let me just say, I think there's a subtext here that we're missing. I think the real danger in this anti-partisan thing is it's a ploy to wipe out what is going to be the big change in American electoral politics, which is that Anglos are becoming a minority. And in Texas and California, they already are. And that's what the new census figures released this week show on the 2009 census, and I'm sure the big census will show it even further. And right now, Latinos, which is the biggest part of the non-Anglo group, tend to vote Democratic for good reasons, because the Democrats have supported a sane policy on immigration. And I see a lot of this nonpartisan stuff as a way of breaking off or confusing Latino voters who would otherwise be supporting the Democrats.
David Frum, do Republicans fear that Carly Fiorina's money is one of the things that has delivered them a Senate nominee who is actually the weaker possibility for the Republicans of what they had to choose from going into the November election? Carly Fiorina, for example, is anti-abortion, which running statewide in California normally is a prohibitive problem for a candidate to take into a general election. We can imagine right now the $30 million in advertising Barbara Boxer's campaign will run about Carly Fiorina trying to take away a woman's right to choose. Isn't that a liability that the Republicans didn't need in their nominee?
Well, perhaps they should fear it, but they don't. Carly Fiorina was clearly favored among national Republicans over Tom Campbell. I would suggest that abortion is less the vulnerability here than the biography. I think Carly Fiorina's biography may not turn out to be such an asset as Bob Scherer was suggesting a minute ago when held up to the glare of a very well-funded opponent's negative campaign ads. I don't know how you can say that Tom Campbell was a tired voice when the nominee is Jerry Brown, whose voice is croaky. I regret Tom Campbell's defeat, but I think that's an unusual minority point of view within the GOP.
We're going to take a short break here, but we'd like to get our audience's notion on their feelings about the Tea Party's prospects in the fall. What is your prediction for the Tea Party's prospects in the fall? We want to know. You can go to our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. We will talk about a Tea Party candidate in Nevada when we come back. Up ahead, we will continue dicing and slicing the primary results, and we'll have our world-famous rants. But first, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, sitting in for Matt Miller, who's on vacation in debt-ridden Greece, the birthplace of our representative from the blogosphere, Arianna Huffington, editor of HuffingtonPost.com. On the right today, David Frum joins us. He's the mind behind FrumForum.com. And on the left, apparently left enough to be from San Francisco, is Robert Scheer, coming to us from San Francisco today, editor of the Webby Award-winning TruthDig.com. Let's move eastward on the electoral map to Nevada, where the Tea Party delivered the nominee that Harry Reid was hoping they would deliver to the Republican Party. There are many observers now of that election who thought Harry Reid didn't have a chance. Now David Frum, many Democrats believe he does. He was congratulated by his Washington Senate colleagues, some of whom had an eye on his office, the possible dreams of being the next majority leader after Harry Reid was defeated. Has the Tea Party basically delivered a looming disaster in Nevada for the Republican Party?
My guess is that Harry Reid probably still loses. It's very hard for a Senate majority leader to make the issue the record of his challenger. It's his record that is going to be on the ballot, and his record is pretty bad. I mean, Sharon Angle said a lot of wacky things, but none of them has done the damage to the United States that, for example, obstructing the Yucca Mountain Nuclear Repository has done. That said, look, I think it's, from my point of view, it's clear the Tea Party has, in at least two races, not only Nevada but also Kentucky, given Republicans, turned easy wins into difficult wins at best, and maybe in Kentucky into a loss. You saw that phenomenon in New York 23. It is just not a good idea to pick your candidate according to look for the most extreme voice without regard to that person's ability, intellect, experience, or electability.
Arianna, I don't think it will be her record so much that Harry Reid will be running against as her enunciated ideas, which include strong streaks of libertarianism, as in let's privatize Medicare and let's get rid of Social Security, and then some odd streaks of totalitarianism, as in perhaps we should go back to prohibition involving alcohol, at least in the state of Nevada, which makes a good deal of money on the over-the-counter sale of that in casinos and elsewhere. Does it look to you as though Harry Reid has been given a life-saving gift here?
I think so. I think he may still blow it, depending on what happens with jobs and foreclosures and the general state of the Nevadan economy. But my God, he has been given an amazing gift, because mixed with libertarianism and totalitarianism is a large amount of wackiness, and who knows what else she's going to come up with unless she's muzzled the way Rand Paul has been muzzled.
Bob Scheer, does it look like the senators who were eyeing the possible majority leader's office will now be watching Harry Reid occupy that office again next year?
Look, first of all, I don't know why we're connecting libertarianism with totalitarianism, except maybe that in this woman's mind.
That's where the connection exists as we know it now.
I understand, but we shouldn't accept it. It's an insult to libertarians who, after all, may fail, but it's in the purity of their opposition to totalitarian impulses on the part of government rather than any tendency to embrace it. I think the rage, however, that fuels the Tea Party movement is real, and I agree with something Arianna just said. I think in Nevada, for example, foreclosures is the big issue, and not some idea of prohibition or what you feel about Social Security, so forth. I think people are hurting incredibly, and it's rarely dealt with as a factor, but I think it's the big factor in the general election. Did Obama fail in his efforts to help the economy, or did he succeed, and was it damage control, or did he worsen it? I think that's going to be the big argument. But, I mean, if I were sitting there in Las Vegas or Reno, I would be voting only on foreclosures. Because, your block is going down the tube. Your life savings are being destroyed. You don't have jobs. It's really a horror. And a lot of times when we have these discussions, here I think, well, maybe we should go out to some of these places and see the for sale signs and see what it's done to people's sense of their own worth, and not just financially, but where they stand in regard to their family, their ability to support their children, and so forth. So I do think this is the big issue. And if the Tea Party can get into it, they'll be well. I happen to, by the way, break with a lot of my pro-labor people in actually having mixed feelings about Blanche Lincoln's win in Arkansas, because on the banking issue, she has been very good. She is the person in the Senate who insisted that over-the-counter derivatives be strictly controlled. She may lose that battle in the negotiations with the House, but I think that she does represent the populist point on the economy. And I think if the Democrats follow her rather than Lauren Summers and the people in Geithner and so forth, they'll do better. But if the Democrats are associated with saving the banks and letting people lose their homes, then they'll be in very big trouble in November.
Bob, thank you very much. Go ahead, Ariane.
Sorry, are we done? If you want us to move to our rounds, I'll do it as my round.
Oh, okay. Well, what I want us to do is move, as Bob so gracefully did, from Nevada to Arkansas. And, Ariana, there's much dispute about what to make of Blanche Lincoln holding on to her Democratic nomination in Arkansas. The White House, the day after, kind of kicked sand on the face of the progressives who had supported Bill Halter, her challenger, by saying that it seemed the unions had wasted $10 million of their dues-paying members' money in a challenge that was, as they put it, pointless. Was that a pointless challenge from the left in Arkansas against a worthy Democratic nominee, Blanche Lincoln?
Well, first of all, since Bob has been celebrating the derivatives amendment that Blanche Lincoln introduced, I'm sure he would agree that this would never have been introduced were it not for the challenge, and which is not a challenge from the left, but a challenge from people who really wanted to see some fundamental change rather than the usual policies that the Washington establishment has been supporting. When it comes to the White House and the some senior staffers claim that the money the union spent was flushed down the toilet, as they put it. That's absurd. And I think it was a really good argument to have because, as the unions have been saying, it's very important for the Democratic Party to stop seeing them as just an arm of the Democratic Party, which admittedly is what they have been most of the time, and where, like the Club for Growth, if you want, they can actually begin to support and encourage candidates who are taking on progressive positions even when the establishment opposes them.
David, from the Democrats have been critical of Sarah Palin and other Republicans on her side of the party as applying, and Tea Party members, as applying some sort of purity test on possible Republican nominees. Is that what it looked like in Arkansas from a Republican perspective? Did it look to you as if some people had decided they were going to apply a purity test on Blanche Lincoln as a Democratic senator and because of her opposition to one provision in the health care bill, the public option, that alone was enough to spark this challenge against her?
The Club for Growth is nicknamed among some Republicans the Club for Electing Democrats, because what it does is it has all these primary challenges, and either it bleeds existing incumbents or else it opens the way to the election, to the nomination of a less electable Republican and the loss of the district to the Democrats. And that has happened over and over again. So it is fascinating to me to watch the unions decide we're going to be the Club for Electing Republicans among the Democratic side. It is always worth remembering that there's not a symmetry here because the Republican base is actually bigger than the Democratic base. About a third of the country identifies as conservative. That's not a majority. But only a fifth of the country identifies as liberal, and that's even farther from a majority. I think there are a lot of Democrats in a lot of places who come October are going to be hungering for that $10 million that is not going to be there for them.
Bob Scheer, it seems that in races like this, the definition of liberal changes over time. Who knew that a couple of years ago the definition of liberal or adherence to Democratic Party principle would be over something called the public option? Bill Halter, Blanche Lincoln's challenger, actually criticized her for voting for Bill Clinton's deficit reduction bill, which included tax increases, in 1993. He didn't label it Bill Clinton's bill because that wouldn't have been the way to label it in Arkansas. But that was considered a liberal vote, and many House members lost their seats over that liberal vote. But apparently there's a shelf life to the value of liberal votes when it comes to these kinds of primary challenges. Do you think that the Democratic Party runs some kind of risk of applying a little bit too strict a purity test on nominees?
Well, no. First of all, let me agree with something Arianna said. I think it's significant that the unions represent the workers and workers that need to be organized. And the conditions in Arkansas are abysmal. They were accepted by Bill Clinton, not just Blanche Lincoln. And he was a partner with Walmart and other companies that were hurting workers. And after all, it was Bill Clinton who did the great welfare reform in Arkansas that really hurt poor people. And then he made it a national program. So I don't look to states like Arkansas for enlightenment. I certainly don't look to Democrats trying to win in those states as progressive leaders of the party. I accept that the unions have a right to pursue their agenda, which I think happens to be a good agenda, in terms of whether they can organize workers and what have you. However, I do think the big issue right now is this populism vis-a-vis the banks, vis-a-vis Wall Street. Is the Democratic Party owned by Wall Street, or is it on the side of Main Street? And I suspect Arianna would agree with me that this party better get its act together and establish on that very critical issue of relation to our economic downfall, which is by no means over. The markets are really going back and forth on this question of whether we're going to have a second big dip. We had a very bad one this week. People are watching their whole retirement programs disintegrate still. They're not. The housing situation is abysmal. The toxic packages are still there. And so I do applaud the fact, for whatever her motives, Blanche Lincoln got it right on financial regulation, and the Obama administration still doesn't have it right. And if they don't get it right, the Democrats will be punished severely in November.
All right. We're going to have to wrap it there. We're going to ask our audience, do you think that people should be allowed to buy their way into public office? Let us know on our blog at kcrw.com/left, right, and center. Now it's time for our famed end of show left, right, and center rants with pet peeves from across the ideological perspective. Arianna, go ahead.
BP and the Chamber of Commerce that now is telling us that it is up to government, i.e. the taxpayers, to shoulder the costs of the cleanup. I love the Chamber of Commerce. They just now discovered that really corporate America cannot afford to clean up after their own mistakes.
David Frum, you have the floor.
Let's pick up on BP. Yesterday, British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg delivered a warning to the Obama administration to stop blaming Britain for this mess. There is today a cover story in the Daily Mail and one of the Daily Telegraph of the increasing unhappiness of the other half of the special relationship with what they take as very pointed nationalistic comments by the Obama administration. This is an administration that's damaged the relationship with Israel. It's done damage to the relationship with Poland and the Czech Republic, and now it looks like it is doing damage to our alliance with Britain, all in order to evade taking responsibility for what are administration mistakes.
Bob Scheer, a quick one.
A quick one. I want to congratulate Arianne Huffington and Truthdig, that I edit, for winning the best political blog from the Webbies. There were 10,000 entries all together, and it shows that without killing trees, you can do good journalism. I think Huffington Post does a great job. I think Truthdig does a great job, and I'm happy that on Monday we'll be both getting awards.
You have the unanimous consent of all of us here at the microphones at Left, Right, and Center today on that one, Bob. That's all the rants we have time for today. Thanks to Arianna Huffington, David Frum, and Robert Scheer. Sarah Spitz produces this program, and our technical director is J.C. Swatek. Thanks also to Darren Peck of Sports Byline and NPR in Washington, D.C. Matt Miller is back next week. I'm Lawrence O'Donnell. Thanks for listening, and come back again next week for another lively edition of Left, Right, and Center.
Oh, so if you like pajamas,
I'll
wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For
we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of home.
You can podcast Left, Right, and Center, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog from our new media player at kcrw.com. Send questions or comments to our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.